Welcome to Counting the Earth, the podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. Now, as you can probably tell, today we're definitely not in the studio because we're starting this episode in Anstruther on the Firth of Forth in the east of Scotland. It's almost 6:30 in the morning. There are one or two seagulls flying overhead. And in the background, you can probably hear the metallic clanging of the odd mast from the boats surrounding us. And there will be waves soon, not now, because it's beautifully calm. But trust me, you'll probably hear those waves a little later on, because we're about to get on a boat to an extremely exciting location and somewhere I've wanted to visit for a very long time.
Looking out across the sea, I can see our destination, which is just a few kilometres away, a tiny slab of rock rising just a few tens of metres above the sea. It is the Isle of May, or the May, as it is known locally, owned and managed by NatureScot. It's one of the most important stopovers on the east coast for migrant birds and is part of a network of four islands around the British Isles that feed into the Seabird Monitoring Programme. On the May, that work is carried out by UKCEH researchers who spend spring and summer on the island collecting data on the breeding success of its 166,000 seabird residents, from kittiwakes and shags, guillemots, and of course, the iconic puffin.
And it's that comic, colourful little bird, the puffin, that gives us our headline number for this episode, 52,000. That's the number of breeding pairs of the bird on the island as calculated in a recent count of the occupied burrows. So that's a lot of puffins, and I for one can't wait to meet them. So Alice, let's get on that boat, head out to meet all the residents of this amazing island, avian and human.
Right, on we go.
Oh, that's brilliant, isn't it? Well, that's been quite a ride for both of us. We're almost there. The boat's about to moor up, and I can see waiting for us Mark Newell from UKCEH, and he's the field manager for the Isle of May.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Isle of May. You've had a nice sunny crossing, slightly bouncy maybe, but you've arrived just in time. The first job of the day is to go on puffin patrol.
Wow, that sounds very exciting. Let's go.
We're by some buildings, Mark. Almost looks like part of a castle there. What is this?
Well, it is a castle, as in that's the name of it. It was old lighthouse keepers' outhouses for stock on the island, so they had horses for pulling their equipment up the island and general workshops and things like that. But yes, being a Northern Lighthouse Board building, it's very ornate and looks far older than perhaps what it is.
Where are we going now and what will we be getting up to?
So we're going to walk some of the walls and around some of the buildings in the middle part of the island. Most of the island's just sort of grassy slopes, but there's lots of obstructions around the human habitation bits, and that's where the pufflings get stuck. So last night in the dead of night, the pufflings would have left their burrows all on their own for the first time and would have been heading for the sea. And most of them walk, some will fly, but those that walk might get stuck behind some of these buildings. And then by the time the sun's come up, they don't want to then expose themselves to potential gold predators, so they just sit it out and wait for the next night. But by which time they're very hungry, so we go around, look for them, pick them up, take them off for some measurements, and then release them on their first maiden flight.
So this is effectively a rescue mission.
Well, we as humans have created these obstructions on what should have been a nice natural island, so we feel like we're giving a bit back by helping them out.
Looking at the way you're dressed, you're in sort of full PPE. You've got one of the sort of white boiler suits on and a mask. Why are you wearing that?
2 years ago, there was widespread outbreak of avian flu. And so as a precaution, both to the birds and ourselves, for the last 2 years when we've been doing any handling work of the birds, we're in full PPE so that we can reduce any chance of spreading it between the birds and reducing what is a tiny chance of getting it ourselves.
Brilliant. Well, lead the way and we'll follow.
Here we are just behind this bit of fencing, and we found two pufflings that have got caught in this little corner. They look fit and healthy, so we'll be able to take these back and release them shortly. Right, so we've got our pufflings that we've just found around the walls. We're back in the castle where we've got the ringing kit set out. We'll take each one out of its bag and...
So cute. It's interesting that if you hadn't said it was a puffling, I wouldn't have known, because it hasn't got the colourful beak. It's got a black beak.
Yes, it's got much smaller black beak, a sort of dark grey face and just grey legs rather than the bright orange legs. And back 150 years ago when these were first seen out at sea and first described, they were thought to be a different species. They didn't realise that young pufflings grew up to be the brightly coloured clowns of the sea that we know.
You're holding it in your hand and its little webbed feet just flapping away there as you get the rings to ring it. You're using pliers to put that on?
Yeah,
that looks painful.
These are specially adapted pliers to fit the size of the ring so that it's not possible to squeeze the ring any more than the size that's needed. And then the ring's got an address and a unique number, so if we find it again, or if anyone else finds it, we can trace it back to today and its time of fledging.
Approximately how old is this one? Because it doesn't look much smaller than the normal size puffins we've seen with the colourful big beaks.
So this would be about 40 days old, and they start fledging at about 40 days. Some may be a bit older if they've not got up to fledging weight yet. They will be a fair bit lighter than an adult, but fully grown and fully able to fly even at this stage.
So you're recording its wing length there with a ruler. What does the wing length tell us about this bird?
Well, it gives an idea of its age. Basically, the wing grows at about 2 millimetres a day so that we can more or less work out how many days old it will be, and also to use that in context with the weight, which will be the next measurement that we take, which will give the idea of condition to see how they've fared for the season, whether they've had enough food and going at a decent weight, or whether they're a bit scrawny or not.
This one is putting up a little bit of a fight, isn't it? It's definitely wriggling around quite a lot.
Yeah, it's a little bit, but it's still being quiet. Yeah, some wriggle a lot more than this, so this one's relatively calm, really, for a puffin. They've got a lot of fight about them, puffins, so, yeah, this one's not too bad. The weighing just involves a cut-off juice container with a hole in the bottom, should it decide to poop while we're doing it, and then it can easily drain out. And then we take the weight of it, and that's it. 285, so it's a reasonable weight for a puffling.
Grams?
Yeah. So adults are usually about 350 grams. Yeah, young ones are always a fair bit lighter, but yeah, decent weight, and he's ready to go back into his bag, and then we'll take him up to the cliff shortly.
It's amazing to think that something that light is soon going to be flying about and diving into the sea. That just seems incredible.
Yeah, and I mean, that's it. They left their burrow last night. They won't see the adults again, so they've got to go straight to sea and learn how to forage themselves, never having touched water before, let alone flying.
And what do they feed on?
Ideally, sand eels. They're generally the most numerous and nutritious of the fish in these waters. So if they can, they'll feed on sand eels, but they'll take anything that they can find. Sprats are probably the better next most nutritious, but it could be young saithe, even young cod. We've certainly seen adults bringing in all sorts of different species for the chicks to feed on, even tiny octopus and squid on occasions.
When will this be released?
Once we've processed all these birds, we'll be taken straight up to the cliff so that they've got the rest of the day to go off and feed.
Well, we've walked to the edge of a cliff. You've got some of the pufflings in bags in your hand, Mark. This is the big moment, isn't it?
It is. It's their maiden flight. So this is a seabird that's never touched the sea before. It's never flown before. It will have only come out of its burrow on the last few nights and flapped its wings to gain the strength. But this is its first flight attempt in its lifetime.
Wow. It's such an incredible thing to be a part of that, really, isn't it? A big responsibility as well.
It is a big responsibility to get it away from the cliff and give it that momentum to get a good few hundred metres out to sea.
Right, well, let's go. You've taken it out the bag. You've got rubber gloves on. And let's get ready for launch.
So give it its wings, its freedom, and then propel it forwards. Off it goes.
Successful flight.
That's a really good flight. That's going to get a good 200-300 meters out, and then hopefully join a few more of the adult puffins out there for a sort of extra protection from any of the gulls that may be loitering around.
Well, we've come to the edge of one of the many cliffs around here, and it's peak puffin now, basically, Mark, isn't it? Why are we here?
Yes, this is a point of the season where there's probably more puffins on the island than any other point of the year. And we've come down to this part of the nesting colony. Here we're checking the burrows that have still got chicks because we want to measure them to see what weight it is that they are before fledging. So obviously we got the weights this morning, but these we measure every day up to the last morning that they're present.
Now you've got two research scientists with you here, and one of them is lying on the ground with her hand deep beneath the ground. Could you describe what she's actually doing?
Yeah, Josie is currently got her arm down a burrow with a short stick in her hand, and she's feeling around to see what's in that burrow, checking to see whether the chick that was still present yesterday has gone or whether it's still down the burrow.
Do they get bitten?
Yeah, if you put your hand in, some adults will just scrabble away and hide at the back of the burrow, or others will come charging forward and give you a decent bite.
We can see she's actually got a chick there, so this one didn't fledge overnight.
Yeah, so that was down the burrow with its parent, so that is waiting to go, maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow night, but it's more or less there.
Well, I don't want to stop you doing your work any longer. Josie, you've come up from having your hand, well, not hand, your whole arm immersed in a burrow. What are you up to now?
Today we're getting some fledgling puffins out of their burrows. These birds have already had rings fitted to their legs, so we know which individual this is. And then we're going to measure its wing length and weigh it to compare how it's changed each day.
Roughly how successful have the puffins been this year compared to other years?
So we have 200 marked burrows that we check twice in the year. So we check them at egg stage early in May, and then we check them again in around late June to see whether they've got a chick. And this year we have 77% of burrows that had chicks, which is 2% above the long-term average. So this year they're doing pretty well.
Well, this looks very similar to what we were watching earlier on with the pufflings, that sort of metal ruler for the wing length, a little notebook. It's wonderfully low key. You sort of can imagine Darwin doing this sort of hundreds of years ago, a little notebook, a pencil, writing down measurements. But this is the way science is done, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, there's a lot of the bits that we do, we're using a stick, we're using an old squash bottle. It doesn't have to be high tech to be able to get the consistent measurements and data that we've been collecting on here for 50 odd years.
The number for the podcast is 52,000, as in 52,000 burrows, each with a pair of adults and hopefully a chick like what we've just seen. That's 104,000 adults alone. That's a lot of puffins. How on earth do you know? Did you count those 52,000? There must be a way to get that approximate number.
It's fairly simple method, but time consuming. So the team back in the end of April walked across the whole island back and forth in transects, counting every hole in the ground, and then interpreting that hole as to whether it was a rabbit burrow or an active puffin burrow, and then tallied those holes up. for the whole island. And within that, there was some smaller plots where we actually got arms down burrows and checked to see whether they're active, and then we could correct for the active burrows.
Obviously, 104,000 puffins is a really high number. How does that compare to previous years?
The last count was in 2017, when there was 39,000 pairs on the island. And in that time, it's sort of gone up considerably. However, we think that the total was higher a couple of years ago. So the place that we're stood at here, a number of the adults here, up to about 100, have got individual colour rings. So we sit in the hide behind us and look out to recite those individuals each year. And we know that in 2021 and 2022, the number that came back was much lower than it should normally be. And so we think the total probably got up way above 52,000, has actually dropped a bit since, but it's still at least an increase on what it was in 2017.
We always think of puffins as rather beautiful, passive birds, because most of the time the only way that we can see them is on the greetings card or something. But tell us a little bit about their behaviour and their personality.
So they're very sociable birds. You'll see them flying around in wheels at the moment, and we're not quite sure some of the purpose for that, but it's
the circles.
Yeah, there's certainly social interactions. You'll see early season, you might see fights around burrows trying to occupy them.
And do they just mate with one mate, a bit like a penguin, and just have one chick?
Yes, so they generally mate for life and laying one egg, rearing one chick a year, hopefully. Obviously, if one partner doesn't make it through the season, they'll look around for a new one. But yeah, generally that's the same pair of puffins in the same burrow every year.
The Isle of May is actually only one of four islands across a research network known as the Seabird Monitoring Programme. So what exactly is that programme trying to understand?
It's trying to understand the state of the marine environment in respect to the seabirds. So the changing fortunes of the key species that occur in the UK, mainly looking at breeding success, but also the survival, and also looking at diet. The four key sites in the UK representing the different sort of corners of the country, and you can compare one to the other and see how the fortunes are changing over the years using exactly the same methodology across the four sites.
You just mentioned there are a few of the different things that can affect them. What are those key issues that might cause the numbers to decline?
So you've got changing fish stocks, you've got sort of like overall climates, are changing sea temperatures could be massively affecting their ability to forage successfully. You know, if you've got warmer seas, the sand eels are the key fish species for the puffins and most of the seabirds, certainly on the Isle of May. And so warmer seas reduce the plankton stocks and reduce the sand eel stocks.
And at what age do they get that characteristic colourful beak?
2 years old, they'll start getting a bit of orange colour through, and then the sort of full blue-orange colours from about 4 years old.
Wow, I never knew that. I really did not expect that.
So are they fairly long-lived birds then?
Most puffins live till about 20 years old,
wow.
But they can go right the way through to sort of into the oldest one from the ringing is 42 years.
Gosh. Wow.
That was on Canna on the west coast of Scotland. I think we've had a few ringer recoveries up to about 39 years from the May.
Eve is also working with Josie here with the chicks. Eve, what are the occupational hazards of doing a job like this? I was a little bit worried about the seagulls.
Yeah, the seagulls can be a bit scary sometimes. You're obviously working quite close to steep cliffs, so you've got to be kind of aware of your footing. You get quite a lot of kind of scraps on your hands and stuff, and just sleep deprivation is quite a lethal one as well, so yeah.
Oh, well, I could very happily spend all day weighing puffing chicks, but there is so much more to explore on this island, and we really wanted to find out more about its rich and colourful history. So Nature Scot Assistant Reserve Manager Thomas Skinner has promised to give us a quick tour, so we better get going.
The Isle of May has been a sort of seat of Christianity since St. Ethelwyn in 600s, where he ministered the fifers in the East Nuke of Fife. And when he died, the site became an important pilgrimage site for for a few hundred years. So in 1145, monks founded a monastery here on the island. They introduced rabbits as a food source, and they mostly took in pilgrims and also healed and cured people here. We're about 200 meters from the shores of Kirkhaven, the North Sea, and we're standing here on the edge of the Priory. The footprint of the area is about 20 by 20 meters.
So that explains all the walls that we see. We've got stone walls here. We've got the ruins, as you said, of the Priory, yes, in front of us. And to be honest, I wasn't sort of expecting that. I expected it to be less evidence of humankind, I suppose, because this island, although relatively close to Anstruther, it's still difficult to get to because you can't always get here if the tide's right, can you?
Yes, it's amazingly remote, and it's amazing that the monks managed to establish here for about 120 years. And then since then, we've had many other people using the island for what was important at the time. The lighthouse keepers, navy men during the World War II, and now a site for scientific research, seabird research in particular.
We're stood in front of the lighthouse now. It looks quite unusual for a lighthouse. It's not a big cylinder that's painted red and white. It's actually square and quite squat, and it almost looks like a castle.
There's a bit of a theme here, isn't there?
Yeah, so this is the Stevenson Lighthouse, the main light we call it, because there's also the low light and the Scotland's oldest lighthouse, the Beacon. But the Stevenson Lighthouse was built in 1816, following a couple of wrecks of ships, and they decided that the existing beacon wasn't doing a good enough job, and we needed to modernise.
It's quite old now. Is it still working?
Yeah, so it was converted to an automated rock station in 1989 and then converted to solar panelled in 2016. So it is still working, but it's fully automatic.
Because it's automated, there's no lighthouse keeper anymore. Does anyone live on the island permanently?
So no one lives on the island permanently anymore. During the season, that's when the most people live here for the longest amount of time. That's from about April till the end of October time. But now the researchers and the staff here, we all live in the lighthouse keeper's accommodation on Fluke Street.
We're walking down to low light now. All right, take a left here, yes, at the flowers. Do you know what? I'm surprised at the number of beautiful flowers here, sea campion and ragwort and scarlet pimpernel.
Forget me nots. I think particularly this year the rabbit population is a bit reduced, so you get a bit more diversity in our floral diversity.
Oh no, it's gorgeous. And Nature Scott, they own the island. How long have you had it?
Yes, Nature Scott have owned the island since 1989 when we bought it from the Northern Lighthouse Board. But it has been a national nature reserve since 1956, which are just places of natural importance to be enjoyed by the people of Scotland.
Yeah, I can see why.
And what is Nature Scott's mission on the island? What do you really want to achieve?
So I suppose you could split our mission into two. The first is to monitor these significant, internationally important seabirds that we have here. Are the numbers changing? And the other aspect of our work here is to share that with the people of Scotland, to get people interested, curious about the natural world, and just to protect this valuable, important, amazing site.
Now, Alice and I saw a number of birds and identified as many as we could, but what are the main types of birds that you find on this island? See if we missed anything out, Alice.
It's a seabird colony, so the main birds are puffins, and we've seen plenty of puffins. You also get guillemots and razorbills, which are part of the auk family. There's many gulls, lesser black-backed, herring, greater black-backed gulls. And we also have cliff-nesting kittiwakes and shags, as well as two smaller birds, small passerines breeding here, pied wagtails and rock pipits.
It is just amazing, the diversity of species that you get. And I think because sometimes seabirds can feel a little bit distant, can't they? We don't see them as much as we do some of the other species, but they're so charismatic, aren't they?
You don't see them very often, but when you come to a place like this where they're breeding, you see them everywhere. They're so abundant. It gives you a lot of chance to sit and watch them because there's so many of them to watch.
And look above us, we're just surrounded by puffins, both on the rocks
to our right, to our left, there's another lighthouse building, more traditional looking one, Alice, a sort of white one. No red stripes, though.
No, but definitely the more traditional shape. Now, this island's got three lighthouses, you said. It's got the big one at the top, this low light, and then the original beacon. This doesn't feel like a particularly big island, so to have three lighthouses seems a bit odd. How big is the island?
The island's about 1.5 kilometres long by half a kilometre wide. I suppose the number of lighthouses just shows the importance that we gave to shipping in this region of the world in the first to fourth, that we'd invest heavily in building grand buildings, grand lighthouses to protect those interests.
Well, the main interests that seem to be protecting at the moment, I love this. There's a short stone wall in front of us down to the lighthouse, and they're about, what, 15 puffins?
Yeah, just stood in a line.
Looking out to sea. They're going to fly off as soon as we get closer, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to walk down McLeod's path now, but the puffins here, they don't let you get too close, unlike other islands. They're a bit more sketchy.
We're just coming up to the low-light lighthouse. What happens here?
So this is run and managed by the Isle of May Bird Observatory Trust. It was set up in the 1930s, the trust, by a group of local birders who were interested in studying migrating birds. And here's Mark, who'll tell us more about what they get up to.
The Isle of May Bird Observatory is a volunteer-run trust, and people come out and spend a week at a time here monitoring the migratory birds that pass through the island.
We've just heard from Thomas about the range of seabirds that we can get here. What other types of migratory birds can you get to this island?
It can be a whole mix. Certainly in the spring, there tends to be a rush of warblers and chats and things like that. The logo of the Isle of May Bird Observatory is a blue throat, which is a particularly striking small robin-sized bird that breeds in Scandinavia and drifts across or gets blown across in easterly winds in the spring. And the Isle of May has had the highest ever day total in the UK, which is how it's ended up with the logo. But the autumn can be full of thrushes. The island can be coated in goldcrests and robins, and sometimes in their thousands.
What's been your most unusual visitor?
I guess probably the one that caused the biggest stir in terms of its rarity was a calandra lark, which should be breeding in Spain or even Southeast Europe. And that turned up here one April and caused boats to descend on the island from all directions with bird watchers trying to catch a sight of it.
I've never even heard of that. What is a calandra, did you say?
Calandra lark.
Calandra. Right,
I'm not even sure what it stands for, but it's basically a big skylark with a big sort of dark wing feathers, nearly twice the size of a skylark, great big chunky thing.
The Migratory Bird Observatory here isn't the only bird observatory in the UK though, is it?
No, there's a series around the UK coast. The Isle of May was the first one in Scotland, and it's the longest operational bird observatory in the UK. But there are several others in Scotland and also down around the Welsh coast and various headlands in England as well.
And what's the benefit of having so many observatories in the UK?
Generally, the recording of the migratory birds is standardised, so there's people going out around the area that the bird observatory will cover on a daily basis. So over time you've got years and years of data to compare arrival times of different species and the final dates of the year that they depart. And with that data we can look at changes in time, and one of the key things that's been picked up is that a lot of migrants are turning up earlier in the year and other species arriving much later. And that's probably due to the sort of changes in temperatures and the overall sort of climate change effect.
And is this the sort of added value that an observatory like the one here gives to you, as well as the research that you're doing?
Yeah, it all helps sort of understand what's going on this island, particularly the work that UKCH do covering the seabirds, and the Isle of May Bird Observatory Trust covering the migrant birds. So you've got everything covered in the one place.
We've already covered quite a lot of the island, but we do have one more location on our tour of the Isle of May, don't we, Mark? Where is our final stop?
We're heading over to the spectacular West Cliffs where our monitoring hides are, and there'll be an array of species scattered around the cliff top.
All right, let's go.
We've reached the Western Cliffs. The raindrops are beginning to fall, but then it wouldn't be a Counting the Earth podcast, would it, Alice, without a drop of rain?
Absolutely. We've been far too lucky with the weather so far. So, of course, at some point it was going to rain.
Yeah, and this is quite an incredible view. There are sort of, at first glance, you'd think they were chalky cliffs, but then you realise they're white for a different reason, because they're covered in probably thousands of birds. And unusually, from what we've seen on the island so far, the majority of them are not puffins. Mark, what are we seeing mostly in terms of the birds in front of us now?
So most of the species in front of us are guillemots, razorbills and kittiwakes. We've left the earthy part of the island with the puffins behind, and this is just bare rock where the guillemots and razorbills have either laid their eggs straight onto the rock face, or the kittiwakes have built a nest on a precarious little promontory and laid their eggs and have now got their chicks in this little cluster of guano covered vegetation.
These species aren't as well known, are they, as the puffins, because they're sort of clown-like, very colourful. So what are the characteristics of these species that we've got in front of us?
So we've got the guillemots and razorbills very closely related to puffins, and they also just lay one egg a season, but they've got very distinct personalities of themselves as well.
In terms of numbers, how do they compare with the puffins, with the 52,000 breeding pairs?
Quite a lot fewer. We've got about 4,000 pairs of kittiwakes on the island and about 13,000 pairs of guillemots and about 4,000 pairs of razorbills. So they're not as numerous, but because they're all out in the open every day of the breeding season, you can see tens of thousands of them on the cliff face, whereas the puffins might be underground or out to sea. So they're a perpetual backdrop to the season.
And looking at the cliffs, compared to the puffins, which were fledging, some of the kittiwake chicks, they're just sort of small grey balls of fluff. They look quite small.
Yeah, I think the kittiwakes will probably be the last species to go this year. They're about a week to 10 days later than normal, and they're also normally the last species to lay anyway. A lot of the guillemots and razorbill chicks, they've also fledged, just as the puffins have, but the kittiwakes are still only sort of halfway through their breeding season.
And how are the different colonies of birds doing at the moment?
Really quite variable. Generally, we've had a good run of 10 to 15 years of decent breeding success and overwinter survival for most of the species on the Isle of May. But they've really taken a hit, particularly last summer, late summer. There was an apparent food shortage. Guillemots and razorbills are really struggling to find enough food after they'd left the cliffs here on the May. And kittiwakes suffered from avian influenza in the last couple of years. So we had quite high mortality for those. And also on the island, the shags, they were decimated by the autumn storms that we had last year. There was about 1,300 shags nesting on here in 2023. But the winter storms caused mass mortality all the way down the east coast, and we've only got about 250 birds nesting on the island this year.
There's quite a range of influences that can affect bird numbers. We've got disease, as in avian flu, you've got storms. Which would you say is the sort of most dangerous out of them all, or is it just a sort of potpourri of peril?
At the moment, it does feel like there's a whole mix of impacts that are really hitting the seabirds. The one hopeful sign is that we've not seen a big impact of avian flu this season, and even last year it was only really affecting the kittiwakes rather than the other species. So hopefully they've weathered that particular storm, but the general sort of climate issues are of greater worry. Certainly surviving storms is an issue, and with the prediction of more and more increase in extreme weather, that will definitely have an impact on several of the species. But warmer seas, will have an impact on the food supply across the board for most of our species.
Thinking about climate change, one of the solutions to help the UK reduce its carbon footprint is offshore wind. And actually, standing on the island when it was clear earlier, we could see an offshore wind farm out in the distance. Do these offshore wind farms have an impact on these seabirds?
It's one of the things that we're looking at in great detail at the moment. So we've been able to put GPS trackers on a variety of species here and just work out at a fine scale where it is that they're foraging. We were able to do that before the wind farm started construction, so we got a natural pattern of their movements during the breeding season. And now that the wind farm's up and just about operational, we will be able to see how that changes, if it does. Having the wind farm may cause the seabirds to avoid that area, so removes that area as a potential foraging area, and it means that if they're going beyond it, they're having to go around it, increasing flight times and decreasing the number of feeds that get into chicks. But there may be benefits. You're creating almost a no-take zone in terms of fisheries, because you won't be getting trawling going through those areas with all the subsea cables as well as the actual turbines themselves. So it's possible that you could be creating artificial reefs as well based around the turbine bases that might provide better areas for the fish, which the seabirds will be feeding on. So there could be negatives, there could be positives, and hopefully with our monitoring, time will tell which of those are having a greater impact.
Mark Newell, Isle of May field manager, thank you so much for hosting us on this incredible island and location. It's been well worth the wait. I've wanted to go here for about 20 years, I think. That's marvellous.
Really appreciate your time, Mark. It really highlights how important that research is, because if we don't understand the impact of future renewable energy and various other things on these birds, then we're not going to understand what the solutions are.
So thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming, making the effort.
Well, it's hard to know where to start in terms of what my favourite bit of the day has been, but for me, I think it's just walking along the island, by the sea, flowers around us, with lighthouses in the distance and birds everywhere, and those puffins flying ahead with their distinctive orange legs trailing out from their rather plumptious little bodies. What about you?
Oh, I think my favourite moment of this trip that is very sadly drawing to an end was on the boat coming in, and it started as a trickle of the odd gannet and guillemot and puffin, and then all of a sudden we were just surrounded. It was like a squadron of puffins circling around us, and I just wasn't expecting that, and they just completely filled the sky, and it was a really incredible thing to be able to watch.
Well, it has been a privilege to see the work that's been going on in the island. And it's good to know that the rise in puffin numbers has gone from about only 2,000 breeding pairs in the 1960s, when the reserve had only been established, really, to what we have this year. 52,000 breeding pairs, our headline number of this episode. Listen to those birds behind us. It's crazy. But it does go to show the importance of these protected spaces for nature.
I think the number that's going to stick with me actually really demonstrates that it's very variable and very different for these different species of birds, because while the puffins have done very well, the number of shags on the island is around 250, which is down from over 1,300 last year. And these are long-lived birds, and they don't start breeding until they're 4 years old, so it's going to take quite a while to build back that colony, assuming we don't have a repeat of those violent storms in the winter this year. So good for puffins, but other species not doing quite so well.
Which seems to be a sort of common theme, doesn't it? There are winners and losers, although often they don't like using that word, winners and losers. It's just change, isn't it? It's fluctuating change. Some species do well and not others. And if we've inspired you from our trips from the May, as this island is known, the good news is that you too can visit. There are day tripper ferries which leave from Anstruther, North Berwick, from Easter to September, and over 10,000 people visit the island each year, and numbers are going up each year, and we can understand why. So you've got to book early. There are limited spaces available and they do get snapped up rather quickly.
Now, sadly, it is time for us to get back on the boat and leave the Isle of May. But thank you so much to all the researchers who spoke to us, and thank you to you for listening. Do join us next time when we take another look at nature through numbers.